Okay, it's good to have you all out this evening. And if you thought you would escape punishment, you were mistaken. There should be a little bit of punishment tonight. Let's see. Since we talked a lot about mathematics this morning, who was the first mathematician in the Bible? Some people think Solomon, but there was one before him. It was Moses. You see, Moses wrote the book of Numbers. It's in there. He did. And let's see. Where is the first prescription given in the Bible? First prescription. Well, it's in the book of Exodus, where God told Moses, take two tablets and see me later. And what man in the Bible committed the greatest number of sins in the shortest possible amount of time? And it wasn't Samson, although he might be a close second. The man who broke the greatest number of commandments in the shortest amount of time was Moses. You see, he broke all 10 commandments simultaneously. No, he did. Okay. All right. Well, let's see now. Just a few more. I've got to have a few more. Don't have enough moans and groans out there yet. But we know a merry heart doeth good like a medicine, so at least it makes my heart merry, if not yours. Anyway, let's see. Who was the first man in the Bible to use a walking stick? First man in the Bible. Well, appropriately, it was Adam. You see, Eve presented him with a little cane. Yes. And by the way, what time of day did God create Adam? Well, it was just a little before Eve. Yeah. Okay. It's in there. And this is good for Nevada with all the gambling here. How did God stop Adam and Eve from gambling? Well, you see, he took away their paradise. Okay, enough groans. All right. Well, tonight, we're going to be looking at the third volume of my series on biomimetics. Now, it's not biomimetrics. Everybody tries to put an R in there. It's not a metric. It's not a measurement. It's mimicry, thus biomimicry or biomimetics. And it is a copying design first seen in the world of biology. So biomimetics really means God invented it first. And man, who is made in the image of God, also has inventive genius, and we create all kinds of things because God has given us that capacity. We're like finite miniature creators. We can think thoughts that were never thought before. We can invent things that never existed before. Why? Because we're made in the image of God. Yet still, our great creator outdoes us in so many ways and such fantabulous ways. And therefore, we're constantly looking at the world of biology in this field of biomimetics to see if there's design there that we can co-opt and use in our own science, our own industry, to benefit us in our own technology. And the irony, of course, is that they recognize this genius design in the world of biology, but they say, wasn't it amazing how what a genius nature is? You know, time and chance, natural laws, chemistry and physics, over billions of years, produced this amazing design. But as we saw this morning, that is a very deceptive lie. They can't even get the first living organism, and if they can't get that, it can't evolve into all the other organisms. Their theory is simply dead, on arrival. Doesn't even get to base one. So God obviously is the one who should be given the glory for the amazing thing he has created, and the fact that secular scientists recognize that genius and want to copy it, whether they realize it or not, does give glory to the Creator, and they should give him public glory as well. Now, one thing that man thought he had invented is body armor. This is, nothing new. The ancients had it. But God invented it first. We can see it in such creatures as the dinosaur known as the Ankylosaurus, very much armored, and also the armadillo. The Spanish named that when they encountered it in the New World. They called it the armadillo. And what does that mean? Means little armored thing, which is a very appropriate name. Now, in the Middle Ages, we developed plate steel technology, where they're able for the first time in Europe to make full suits of body armor. But God even beat them to that with the box turtle. The box turtle has these hinges here and trap doors at each end, and it can pull in its head and neck and feet, pull in its rear feet and tail and close that up, and if you can't get through that armor with teeth or whatever, it's better than a full suit of armor. The knight If he was knocked off his horse, was dismounted, he has only chainmail in the crotch and in the shoulder, underneath the armpits there, that's to allow movement and not to overheat, and also the eye slit that he has to see out of. Once he's dismounted, the dagger could go right through any of those places, unlike the full suit of armor that God gave to the box turtle. If you can't get through that armor, it is invulnerable. Now then, let's use the wrong one there. There we go. Here we have an Elizabethan man of war. And when they first started putting a significant cannon, arming these sail ships, they parted with maritime tradition, which was that ships were always named after women. But they thought if we're going to put a lot of guns on a ship and make it formidable and fearful to the enemy, then we don't want to call it a woman of war. So they decided to break with tradition, and they called it the man of war. But a sail ship, formidably armed as a man of war, was not something man invented first. God invented it first with what is known as the Portuguese man of war. It also has a sail, an inflatable sail, that it uses the wind power to drive it around just like a sail ship as its means of motivation. It's not a jellyfish, it's actually a different type of creature. Although it does have these long tentacles with neurotoxin in them that if fish swim into them, they get stung and paralyzed, and then they're drawn up and digested by this creature. Some of these have measured, historically, up to 150 feet long, if you can imagine that. Although normally it's usually only about 30 feet, which is still quite long. So having a sail ship with formidable armament is not something man thought of first. God invented it first. Now God also invented the diving bell. The diving bell is not a great technological achievement. It's not very complex, but it is very practical. Prior to the invention of the diving bell, if you found sunken treasure, people had to take a deep breath and free dive down, didn't have any scuba gear, and gather whatever they could in a basket as quick as they could to be hauled up to the ship. Then they had to swim all the way back, catch their breath, dive down again, and a lot of time and effort was raised going from the surface to the depths and back again. With the diving bell, you have trapped air there, so you can put treasure, sunken treasure, in the basket, haul it up, and then just go a short distance into the diving bell, catch your breath, and come back out. Later versions, of course, had air piped into it to keep a constant amount of fresh air, so it could stay there indefinitely. But this is not something man thought of first. God invented it first with the amazing diving bell spider. The diving bell spider actually spends most of its life underwater, not above the water. And it doesn't have gills so that it can breathe like a fish underwater. But God gave it certain hairs on its abdomen, which it mixes its spider silk with, and that allows it to trap a bubble around its abdomen. Then it dives down, and it actually makes a diving bell out of spider silk. And then it scrapes those bubbles off of its abdomen, and it fills up that diving bell. Now, spider silk is incredibly strong. Gram for gram, it's stronger than steel. So it works very well as a diving bell, and it just sits in there and breathes the air in there. If it sees any prey coming by, it swims out and gets it. So God was the first one to invent the diving bell. Now, the honeycomb represents actually pretty much mathematical perfection. If you want to have the greatest volume and the greatest strength with the least expenditure of material, you really can't beat the honeycomb. It really represents mathematical perfection. And because of that, from ancient times to the present, we have copied it. We can't really improve on it. It's like the old adage, if you can't beat them, join them. And that's why with wax, I mean, these bees produce wax on the bottom of their abdomen, their own wax, and they collect it and use the wax to build the honeycomb. And this hexagonal design can be proved mathematically and geometrically to be the most optimum design that exists for this. Because of that, great strength to weight ratio, just 1.2 pounds of honeycomb can securely hold 50 pounds of honey. It's really amazing. With nothing more than wax. You know, wax isn't even all that strong, but when you put it in this configuration, it has tremendous strength. Now, the ancients realized this. Here we have this big temple in Rome. Anybody ever been there? But you know what it is? This is called the Pantheon. Pan means many or all, and theon refers to the gods. So it was a temple built to honor all the gods. Now, the amazing thing about it is it was considered to be one of the engineering achievements of the ancient world, one of the wonders of the world, in that it has this huge freestanding dome. That's not easy to engineer, even by today's standards. But the ancients were able to do it. Now you see the size of the people here at the portico. This is truly a huge building. And it looks very impressive on the inside too. It has at the center of the dome glass, which they call an oculus, which means an eye. We would call it a skylight. But way back 2,000 years ago, they had the idea of a skylight. Now, on the interior, on the interior of the dome, it has these kind of square or rectangular panels. That's kind of for an artistic effect. But when they did renovation to make sure everything was working all right, an inspection of the dome, they found that on the interior of the dome up here, guess what the Romans used? Honeycomb structure. Because they realized if you want the greatest strength with the least weight, you can't beat it. And of course, you don't want the dome to collapse under its own weight. So you want to make it as strong as possible, but as light as possible. And so they chose that way back then. It's used in the 21st century today. You're in a BMW car. Areas under the car that are hidden, where you're not going to see it, but where you need lightweight strength, they still use the honeycomb pattern to this day. Of course, in automobiles, the lighter the vehicle is, the faster it can go with less fuel consumption. But you don't lose anything really in structural strength when you use the honeycomb design. The military also, of course, has used this for a long time. This is actually a 40-millimeter grenade launcher that was entirely produced by 3D printing. And yes, they can print in metal alloys nowadays. They actually heat the metal to its melting point so it's liquid, like ink, so to speak. Oops. And then they print it all out. But notice the handle, what did they choose? Something the ancient Romans chose, because you can't beat it to this day. The honeycomb design to give it great strength, but very lightweight. The aviation industry, of course, has used the honeycomb in wing structure, fuselage, and control surface structures, again, because you want lightweight in aviation, but you want all the strength. The problem is that the honeycomb turned out to be very efficient in transmitting vibration and noise. And they realized if we put a kind of a buffer in here, in between the middle of the honeycomb in the structure, that would absorb a lot of that noise and make it much quieter. So you'll notice as they start to incorporate this in the engineering designs, the jets and even helicopters will be much quieter than they were in the recent past. So from ancient times with the ancient Romans up into the 21st century, indeed to this day, it's an optimum design that God thought of first, and we can't beat it, so we simply copy it. This is biomimetics in its purest form, copying directly the design that was first ingeniously thought of and created by God. Now, God also gave the wisdom to use the hexagonal honeycomb design to wasps. Now, wasps can't make their own wax the way bees do. They don't have glands for that. So what they do is they go out and they harvest wood fibers, and they chew them up, masticate them, and their saliva is full of certain binding proteins and enzymes that act like a kind of a biological superglue. And then they just chew it into a pulp, and the glue that's in it holds it together, and they put it in that perfectly, mathematically perfect, strong, lightweight construction in the wasp comb there. Now, amazingly, God gave the wisdom to wasps to make paper out of wood fiber before we ever did. The old days, they used linen and cotton. And in some applications, we still use cotton today, for example, in currency, because it's a little more durable than wood fiber. But wood fiber is a whole lot more practical because it doesn't cost near as much as cotton. So almost all paper today is actually made out of what the wasps were first given the wisdom by God to make, made it out of wood fiber. Now, René Antoine Remeur, centuries ago, he was an entomologist, a scientist who studies insects. And he said, "The American wasps form very fine paper. They teach us that paper can be made from the fibers of plants without the use of rags and linens, and seem to invite us to try whether we cannot make a fine and good paper from the use of certain woods." Well, I think we did that, didn't we? Almost all paper today is made after God's original design out of wood fiber rather than something else. Now, antifreeze is certainly something man probably pats himself on the back and says, "Well, we thought of antifreeze. God didn't think of that first," but wrong again. God thought of it first. And it's a biological antifreeze that allows certain creatures, such as the eastern box turtle and the wood frog. Now, the wood frog can be way up, in Alaska. And yet both of these, in the winter, dig a very shallow burrow with no more than about an inch of, you know, leaves and dirt on top of them, which is not deep enough to keep them from freezing. Yet, they don't die from freezing in the winter. You can dig them up in the middle of winter, and you'd swear they're dead. They feel cold as ice. They're stiff like they have rigor mortis. And they're in sub-freezing temperature. Now, the problem with the freezing, I know it's bothering my throat tonight. All the smoke must have finally been getting to me. So, appreciate your prayers in that regard. But the problem is that when cells freeze, ice crystals are formed. And those sharp ice crystals will penetrate the cell membranes and thus produce lethal damage. So you have to have antifreeze that's delivered at the right time before the freezing temperatures hit so that it can get very, very cold without ice crystals forming. That's the key. So God concocted a kind of a biological antifreeze based on glucose and other anti-cryogenic proteins, kind of a anti-cryogenic biological cocktail, so to speak, that is released at the right time before the first heavy freeze and allows these creatures to hibernate in a very extraordinary way. They're not only at sub-freezing temperature, they appear to be dead because their heart stops beating. But they're not dead. When you're really dead, you don't have any feedback system that can react to the environment. These appear to be dead because their heart has stopped beating, but in that cold cryogenic state, there's no decay or deterioration. So they're like in a state of suspended animation. But there are biological feedback systems that are still operating. And so it has a built-in thermometer and a sensor that when the temperature reaches the right amount in the spring, it kickstarts the heart, it starts beating again, and it's virtually like a resurrection from the dead. It only works because God invented antifreeze first, and it is a type and shadow that there is a God who indeed can raise the dead, even after 4 days, and Lord, by now he stinketh, like Lazarus. So when you're dead in a very warm environment, you start stinking pretty quick, I think. Of course, Jesus waited 4 days on purpose. Also, the Jewish concept was that the spirit was attached to the body by a silver cord for 3 days. He wanted to wait 4 days so that they couldn't say, well, he was still attached. That's why he was able to raise him. No, he was dead as a doornail and stinking. And only the creator of the universe can take a dead, rotting, stinking corpse and make it a perfectly healthy, living, breathing human being again. Because he is the creator and the author of human biological architecture. Now, deer hunters would do just about anything to bag a deer, including the ignoble fate of rubbing deer urine upon their bodies. That's to hide their own smell and to, you know, for example, a female deer's urine when she's in estrus gives off a scent that attracts bucks, you know, because it's like the rut, it's the mating season. And so it not only hides your scent, but it makes you smell like something you're not in order to give you an advantage over your prey. Well, that is not the first, idea that man came up with. Make yourself smell like something else and you'll have an advantage over your opponent. God thought of that first. And he gave this amazing ability to a moth called the death's head moth. Now you see on the back of the moth what looks like a skull with two big eye sockets, hence the appropriate name, the death's head moth. This moth has an amazing chemical factory. It can go near to a beehive, and sniff the air and draw the hive-specific pheromone into its body. Now, beehives all have a very specific smell, a very specific pheromone that identifies that particular hive. If a bee comes from a nearby hive and he by mistake tries to go into another hive, the soldier bees, the guard bees, sniff him and say, hey, buddy, you don't belong here, you don't smell right. You know, you need to go somewhere else. If he keeps trying to get in, they'll kill him. Because if you want to get into the beehive, it's more important how you smell than it is how you look. So the death's head moth will sniff that in, and God gave it an amazing chemical factory that will analyze that specific pheromone and produce a chemical cocktail that so closely mimics it as a counterfeit that the bees can't tell the difference. And so it then exudes its own counterfeit pheromone. It comes under cover of darkness when the bees can't see that good anyway. It doesn't look a whole lot like a bee, but again, it's better to smell like a bee than to look like a bee. So at night, the guard bees can't see it very well. They say, well, fella, you don't look too good, but you know, you smell like you belong here, so we're going to let you in. So it goes in, siphons off some honey, and gets back out. Now, it has to do that very efficiently because the pheromone doesn't last a very long time. And if it wears off while it's in the hive, everybody would go, ooh, I smell an intruder, and it would get stung to death. But it goes to show this strategy of smelling like something that you're not in order to have an advantage over your opponent is not something man thought of first. God thought of it first with the amazing death's head moth. Now here we have the Namibian beetle, which lives in a very dry desert, the Namibian desert in Africa. However, this desert is by the seaside, and hence it can get fog blowing in off the sea. It doesn't hardly ever get rain. The fog, you know, blows in, and then as the day heats up, it just kind of dissipates and disappears. Very rarely will it form clouds to have rain. However, this beetle has been designed by God to be able to extract incredibly efficiently water out of fog. And it does it with the design of its shell here. Okay, so it has these bumps on its outer shell, and the proteins at the tip of the bumps are what we call hydrophilic. In other words, they love water. They attract water. Water easily condenses on them and it makes like, you know, a big ball of water that then sloughs off of the bump into these gutters. The gutters have proteins that are hydrophobic. In other words, they repel water. So it builds up on these bumps. It sloughs off into these gutters. The beetle tips his rear end up. So gravity causes the water to flow down these gutters right to his head and into his mouth. And he drinks the condensed water out of fog. And hence it is able to live in one of the driest deserts in the world. Now, the amazing thing is that we also thought of this idea after God had done it. And as usual, we may have thought of the same idea, but we didn't make it near as efficient. We used fog nets. So the fibers of the nets cause the moisture in the fog to condense into liquid, and then it drains by gravity down into a receptacle. Well, this works, but analysis showed that the design of the Namibian beetle was 10 times more efficient at extracting moisture out of fog than our best fog nets. That tenfold increase really is significant. Now then, that has allowed us to make things like this, spikes, using the Namibian beetle design that if you're camping, you can set it out on the picnic table at night, and if it's foggy, or even if it's just humidity in the air, it will condense water out of the atmosphere and form liquid water at the bottom. So this actually will open up areas like the Namibian desert that were virtually uninhabitable for lack of water. But this is so efficient in extracting moisture out of fog that if the village's houses were built with this Namibian beetle design on the roof and on the sides of the house with collection systems, you get all kinds of water condensing out of that fog that could then be collected. And you could have thriving communities in areas that otherwise would have been practically uninhabitable. We may actually fight wars in the future over supplies of fresh water, because fresh water is a diminishing resource in our modern world. But by looking at the design, God thought of first, at least in some areas, we'll be able to get water where it was simply not possible before. Now, does anybody know the name of this beautiful flower? What's that? Water lily, also known as the lotus, okay? And the lotus is amazing in that its leaves cleanse automatically when it rains. You don't have to scrub them down with detergent or anything. They're self-cleaning. Now, trying to figure out, scientists thought, how in the world does it do that? They used microscopic analysis, and they found that the surface of the leaves have all these little pinnacles microscopically on them. That means that water can't flatten out. It always balls up in balls and rolls off. And as it rolls, it collects any particles of dirt with the water and carries them off just as effectively if you scrubbed it down with detergent. So a paint company decided they were going to mimic that, copy that. So they invented a paint that when it dries, it produces these microscopic pinnacles on its surface, causes water to ball up. And as it drips off, it collects all kinds of dirt. As you can see, this one's very dirty, and the one behind it is practically clean because it's very efficient in lifting those dirt particles off and carrying them away. And the paint company that did that named themselves Lotusan, named after the lotus flower. So paint your house like this, you'll never have to scrub your house. Anytime it rains, if it doesn't rain, just spray it with a hose, and it'll clean as if good as if somebody scrubbed it with detergent. This also should be applicable to car finishes. Imagine never having to pay for a car wash. I don't think the car wash company is too happy about this new technology that we copied from God, but I would like it. I hate paying for car washes, and you know, even if it doesn't rain, you just spray your car with your hose. You don't have to wipe it down at all. All the dirt is carried away by this marvelous design that God thought of first. Now, subduing an opponent by electrical discharge, something we're very familiar with today, use of tasers, but of course God invented that first, didn't he, with the amazing electric eel, which is able to deliver up to 830 volts in a single discharge, able to disable and even sometimes kill rather large creatures, like crocodiles. So it can defend itself against predators, it can stun with electricity like a taser its prey before it eats it, something, again, God invented first, long before we ever invented the taser. Now here we have the firefly, which is actually a misnomer. It's actually a beetle. And it uses something known in biology as bioluminescence. And this is based on chemical oxidation, the oxidative process releasing very efficient light with very little heat. Now most of our lights, especially incandescent bulbs, much of the energy is wasted in heat. The infrared spectrum of light is invisible, so it doesn't illuminate anything to us unless you have infrared goggles or something like that, which our eyes don't have ordinarily. But a lot of it's wasted in heat rather than light in the visible spectrum. This delivers the best amount of visible light with very little heat. It's called cold light. Bioluminescence is based on a certain biological compound called luciferin, which is acted upon by a catalytic enzyme called luciferase. And that causes an oxidative reaction, and the oxidation produces this very cold but very efficient light. Now, back in the 60s, Bell Labs thought, you know, we might like to do that, you know, make our own cold light by mixing chemicals that oxidize, getting the idea, of course, from the firefly and bioluminescence in nature. And so they figured they didn't want to use the biological chemicals because they're way too complex to effectively manufacture both efficiently and cost-effectively. So they figured they'd use hydrogen peroxide, which is readily available, and then they experimented to find another chemical that would readily oxidize with it and produce this cold light. Well, they finally found the optimum one, and by 1971, they put glow sticks on the market, clear back in 1971. How many of you knew that? Well, glow sticks are still used today. The problem was, when it came out in 1971, it was practically ignored. It looked like it was going to be a flop. Nobody seemed interested in it. And so Bell Labs didn't even bother to patent it. They thought they had a flop on their hands. Well, a decade later, in the 1980s, it became very popular, and it is still popular to this day. But because they didn't file the patent on it in time, you can go to the dollar store, and from China, you can get a whole big pack for a dollar of these glow sticks. But again, God invented the concept first. Now, another thing God invented was the ability to have a light bulb, so to speak, the cuticle of the firefly, allows light to pass through it more efficiently than our standard light bulbs. And the reason is because our light bulbs have about at least a 5% reflection factor. As it tries to go through the glass or the plastic, some of it's reflected back, and thus it's lost, it's useless. But in examining the cuticle of the firefly, they realized it transmits light more efficiently than any of our light bulbs. What is the secret? So they looked at it microscopically, and they found that there were these little ridges that were like engraved on the cuticle of the firefly. In examining the microscopic distances, how long these were, they found out they corresponded exactly to the wavelength of that light coming out of the firefly. So if you engrave these etchings onto light bulbs, which we could easily enough do with precision lasers, you'd get an automatic 5% efficiency, much less reflection back in, 5% more light without having any extra expenditure of energy. Now, 5% doesn't sound like a lot, but you put that on a global basis, you'd save all kinds of money in energy, because God thought up the first most efficient means of transmitting light and put it into the firefly. Now, here we have the humpback whale, and humpback whales are distinguished by having these huge, long fins. The leading edge of the fins have these ridges, kind of bumps, serrations, whatever you want to call them. They're technically called tubercles. And somebody finally realized that's not just a quirk of evolution or something. That must have a design purpose. That must make it more efficient to pass through the water, especially at lower speeds. Now, high-speed fish, high-speed mammals, like dolphins, their fins are curved and smooth, because at high speed, that's the more efficient way to go. But the humpback whales don't usually swim all that fast at all. They're pretty lazy swimmers. And at a slower speed, it appears that having the leading edge like that with these bumps and ridges is more hydrodynamically efficient. So with that in mind, a company decided to put those kind of tubercle edges on the leading edges of these big twirling wind turbines that we have, and they made it look like this, and what happened was immediately 32% increase in efficiency. So the blade itself has less resistance to the wind. That means it can turn faster with a lower volume of airflow. What that means is that whole areas that used to be not good for wind farming because it had steady winds but they weren't high velocity enough can now be utilized this way. Because of the efficiency of this design, you can produce just as much energy at 10 miles per hour as what traditionally it took at least 17 miles per hour to produce. So that will be a definite increase in our efficiency by copying the superior design that God put in the humpback whale. Now, this also has applications in fans, large industrial fans. By putting these tubercle edges on the leading edge, they immediately got a 25% reduction in energy cost because it turns easier with less drag, therefore requiring less energy. Now, here we have the Emma Maersk. This huge cargo ship is the largest class of cargo ship in the world today. It is about 200 feet longer than a Nimitz-class aircraft carrier, to give you, an idea of how big and long it is. Here we have something like a guided missile frigate or something that was just dwarfed in comparison to the size of this huge container ship. Now, back in the day, like with the Titanic, the conventional wisdom was you had multiple propellers with multiple propeller shafts. The Titanic had three propellers. Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth had four. But in more recent times, they've realized having a single propeller shaft with a very large propeller was actually easier to build and more efficient. So how big is the propeller on the Emma Maersk? It's more than 10 yards, more than 30 feet in diameter. So its diameter is as tall as a three-story house. And it turns slowly. Because of its mass, with slow turning, it still gets plenty of thrust very efficiently. So I don't know if you can see this worker here. There's his white hard hat right there. He's standing right there. If he had a football and he threw it to a friend over here, he'd get a first down. It'd be a full 10 yards, okay? Now, because these propellers turn relatively slowly because of their size, we could put those tubercles, those serrated edges on them, and get even greater efficiency out of them than we currently do. Especially, this would have application in stealth for submarines. Submarines always have to have slow-turning propellers. Why? Because if they turn too fastly, they produce cavitation. In other words, bubbles. Those bubbles pop, and they give off a sonar signature that's very easily tracked by the enemy. So you always have to have very slow-turning, very hydrodynamically efficient blades. But in this case, by putting the leading edges like we have on the humpback whale, it would be even more efficient with even slower speed and even greater stealthiness. So we can expect to see that on some of our newer submarines. So God thought of the design first, put it in the humpback whale. We have copied it with wind turbine technology, fan technology, boat and submarine technology, and another application is in aeronautics, aeronautical design. Nowadays, we have a lot of these drones that aren't high-performance jets. They don't have to fly fast. Their main attribute is that they can stay around for a long time. They can loiter, and thus they can be there. If the enemy pops his head out or does anything, they can surveil it and see it, and if they're weaponized, they can actually attack. But the main thing you want is a slow platform that has a long time on station. Well, if we put those serrated edges, those tubercles, on the leading edges of the control surfaces and the wings, all the data seems to show they'll be much more efficient, and thus they could stay on station much longer than before. So when you start seeing this in the aviation industry and fans and everything like that, you'll know man didn't think of that first. God thought of it first. Man has simply copied it, because that's what biomimetics is all about, copying design that God thought of first. Now, sharks are amazing, and especially basking sharks. Basking sharks live up to their name. They like to bask. They just lazily swim. They don't swim very fast. Now, in the cases of like dolphins or sailfish or marlin that swim very fast, they don't have to worry about colonies of bacteria building up on their skin and their scales, because the velocity of the water passing over them as they swim fast rips those colonies off. It's like self-cleansing. But this shark swims so lazily, scientists couldn't figure out how in the world does it keep colonies of bacteria infecting its skin. So they examined it microscopically, and they found that the shark's scales had this design in them, and a kind of identical design with these ridges in it. And they thought, analysis showed that actually physically prevents the bacterial colonies from adhering to it. It repels them. So it's not a disinfectant, it's not an antibiotic, it's literal physical prohibition of the bacteria adhering to it. So a company by the name of Sharklet, taking their name from the shark, the basking shark, decided to mimic that design and use it especially in hospitals, you know, for bed rails, door handles, anything that's constantly touched by people's hands, because it keeps these diseases from being transmitted. Bacterial diseases can't adhere to it. If it can't be transmitted, then you can't get it transmitted to you for sickness. This is actually very necessary. We have a big problem in our hospitals. Staff infections especially cause a lot of deaths, you know. It's one of the most dangerous places to go as a hospital. It should be one of the safest places because it's so common to get staff infections and other infections, you're really taking your life in your hands going to a hospital. This should physically prevent the transmission of a lot of microorganisms just by a design that God thought of first that we have co-opted to use in our own technology. Now, glass is something that man probably thought he invented, and it's ancient. You know, the Greeks and the Romans had invented glass. One thing they didn't figure out was how to make glass clear. That's why when Paul writes nearly two millennia ago, "We see now as through a glass darkly," people in his day knew exactly what he was talking about. You know, today the millennials might think, "What do you mean? It's not dark, glass is crystal clear." Well, it is today, because we figured out the right chemical recipe to make clear glass. Back then, the ancient Greeks and the Romans didn't. Glass was always cloudy, foggy. It allowed light to come through, but much like these lights here, you know, it's translucent but not transparent, so it was hard to see through. Well, God not only invented glass, he invented clear glass, and he invented it before man ever did. In fact, another thing God invented was glass houses. This is such an interesting concept. I would love to have a house like this. Three-story house, and if you're out in a rural area where there's nobody around, you know, it does have curtains you can draw if you need privacy, but if you're out in a rural area where there's nobody around, you open those curtains up, you have the true panoramic view of whatever there is there. At night, if your bedroom is on the top floor, you look through the clear glass of the ceiling and see the beautiful stars, the moon, the Milky Way. I mean, what an awesome concept, a house made out of glass. But even this is not something man invented first. God invented it first. And he did it with amazing creatures. Also, we have artwork made out of glass. This is a glass starfish. Okay? We make artwork out of glass. We've known that for a long time, but God was the first one to do it, to not only make glass, but to make houses out of glass and artistic artwork out of glass. This is seen in the microscopic marine creatures called diatoms. They're able to extract silica, the main component of glass, out of the water and fashion their own houses, intricate, beautiful, aesthetically pleasing houses, all out of glass. Here we have one of those diatom houses. A little microorganism, single-celled creature, lives in there and fashioned this beautiful house. Why does it have to be beautiful? You know, that cubed house that I showed, that's perfectly functional, looks like a cube. But God is not just the great engineer, he's also the great artist. And that's why we see such an artistic and aesthetic flair throughout the world of biology. Because he doesn't just engineer things to be survivable. He engineers them to be beautiful and aesthetically pleasing. And because we are made in the image of God, we see beautiful things like that and we go, "Oh, isn't that beautiful?" It doesn't have to be to survive. But God, who is artistic, puts his artistic flair into even microscopic things. Now these diatoms are so tiny. They come in so many different sizes and colors and shapes. They estimate that out in the sea, if you were to take a gallon bucket and scoop it into the surface of the sea, you'd have up to a million of these diatoms in that 1 gallon of water. But they're so microscopic, you can't really see them and appreciate them until the invention of the microscope. So for all these centuries, God had all this artistry there, beautiful artistry, with these amazing single-celled creatures and the homes they built for themselves. Just like gems, just, you know, beautiful to behold. We couldn't even appreciate it until these last days with the invention of the microscope. Just like so many of the glorious, beautiful things in the heavens could not be seen until we invented really good telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope. So we live in a privileged time in these last days. Here we have other diatoms. Again, there's just so many different shapes, sizes, colors. They look like, you know, a treasure chest of gems. It doesn't have to be that way. They could all be cubes or squares, and they'd live and function just fine. But God is such an amazing artist, and because of our technology to now with microscopes, we can see this beauty that was hidden for so many centuries. And they even have swirling, curling shapes, as we see in this particular diatom. There are other microscopic creatures that make glass houses, the Radiolaria. And the Radiolaria don't usually have quite all the colors, but they do have amazing, fascinating, aesthetic shapes that they make their houses out of. And here we have a few examples there. These are actually drawings done by the famous scientist and artist Ernst Haeckel, who was famous for the embryological recapitulation theory, which has been thoroughly disproven by science. But he was quite an artist, I'll give him that. You think he would have appreciated the artistry of God. Now, he made drawings of diatoms that had died in the past, and their glass houses, of course, were still preserved in the sediments at the bottom of the ocean. So they dredged up sediments from the deep ocean, and they found all these microscopic, beautiful glass houses made by diatoms that don't actually live anymore. Probably changes in the water chemistry, the pH, temperature, etc., as a result of the great flood of Noah, caused them to go extinct, although we still do have some alive today, obviously. But the ones in the past did even greater works of art with their glass houses. This one looks kind of like a hot air balloon. This looks like a chandelier of some kind. These look like gazebos, you know, miniature microscopic gazebos. These, I'm not sure what they look like, but they sure don't look like they happened by a bunch of blind random accidents in the DNA blueprint. You know, these obviously have aestheticism and beauty to them that transcends what can happen by chance and natural laws of chemistry and physics. Now, any of these, if they were to be found as ornaments on a modern Christmas tree, people would say, oh, what elegance, what beauty. Oh my goodness, tell me the glass factory that produces these beautiful glass crystal ornaments. I want to get some for my own Christmas tree. And what if somebody said, well, you know, nobody designed these. You know, but the glass factory down the street, they had an explosion a while back, and the explosion randomly reprogrammed the blueprints in their computer. And after that, they plugged in the computer and look what popped out. Nobody would believe such an idiotic idea. Nobody would. But they tell us that life, much more complex than these glass structures, did happen just that way by a bunch of accidents. It's really ludicrous in the extreme. So they are indeed works of art and are there for our enjoyment even at the microscopic scale. Now, because they are considered such works of art and man is by nature aesthetic, as God himself is, we have made ornaments to copy them, such as these pendants. Here we have a Radiolarian queen with Radiolarian crown and garb. Here we have a Radiolarian that was directly copied for a conversation piece or a container of some kind, and other conversation pieces inspired by the design we see in the Radiolarium. Here we have a chalice and decanters, again, inspired by the design God put there first. This one is really cool, and an artist decided just to copy it directly. He said he couldn't improve on it, so he just made a copy out of aluminum. And those who work in wrought iron have also made copies. You know, artists know beauty when they see it, because God put that in us. And when they see this, they go, hey, we want to copy that. That's biomimetics. This one was used as the inspiration for this pavilion at the 1901 Paris World Exposition, which today, or later at least, they called World's Fairs. This one was directly copied in colored brass by the artist. And glass blowers, of course, these are made out of glass. So glass blowers says, why don't we copy them with what they're made out of? And they copy them as novelties in glass blowing. They're also put on T-shirts, again, because they're just so aesthetically pleasing to human beings. Now, the greatest compliment to them is just to put them on a microscope slide and view them directly. And you can go to places on the internet where they do this. They take Radiolaria and diatoms, put them on a microscope slide, and if you have a good optical microscope, you can order these off the internet and look at them yourself. And, of course, they arrange them in certain patterns, like this is arranged in the style of a Victorian cross, because man is aesthetic and beauty is pleasing to him. He says, I see beauty here, I want to enhance it. Put it in designs like a star or whatever. So many of these microscopic slides that you can order have been arranged by human artists to enhance the artistry that God already put there, because they're just a joy and beautiful to behold. And It's something that God had hidden for all these centuries, but we can indeed enjoy this marvelous beauty at the microscopic scale today because of the widespread use of microscopes. So God was the first one to make glass. He was the first one to make artworks out of glass, the first one to make houses out of glass with the diatoms and with the radiolaria. Now here we have the Great Pyramid of Egypt, which has somewhat deteriorated. They estimate that at its perfection, when it was first made, it was about 480 feet high. And it remained the highest man-made human structure for thousands of years until in the early 1300s they built a cathedral in Europe that was just a little bit higher. It took almost to the 20th century with the building of the Eiffel Tower before there was a man-made structure that was more than twice as tall as the Great Pyramid of Egypt. But when you consider the size of things in proportion to the workers who actually built it, in other words, how big this is compared to humans, and how big termite mounds are compared to the size of little termites, which only average about a third of an inch in length, in proportion to their size, they have built the biggest skyscrapers in history. And we still don't have anything that can beat them to this day. Okay, now, toward the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, they invented a new process of making steel that made it much more efficient and therefore much less expensive. And thus steel became widely available, whereas it used to be too expensive to use that much, and they used them to build huge skyscrapers. For example, here we have the Chrysler Building completed in 1930. It was briefly the tallest skyscraper in the world until in 1931 the Empire State Building was completed, and it remained the tallest skyscraper in the world for nearly 40 years. But this is nothing new. God had creatures who could make, in proportion to their own size, bigger skyscrapers than anything we have built to this day. And I'm referring to termites. Here in Australia, we have a termite mound. And, you know, it's tall, doesn't seem tall as a skyscraper. But considering how tiny termites are, a third of an inch long, if the termites were to build something in proportion to their size, that would be like the Empire State Building, because of their small size, they'd build something like this, and that would be equivalent to the Empire State Building. In other words, what they have built is much bigger and taller than our Empire State Building when you take in the proportionate size that they are compared to the edifice that they have built. And they're very strong. You know, these things are made out of simple components: earth, dung, and termite saliva. Now, keep it simple. Yet it's strong like concrete. You know, elephants, which weigh up to 6 tons, can come and rub their itching rears on them hard, and they don't crumble or fall apart because they're strong as concrete. It's truly amazing. Now, here we have the currently tallest skyscraper in the world. Anybody know where it is? Dubai. And it's the Burj Khalifa, which means the Tower of the King. Okay, and it is over a half a mile high. That's pretty high. So maybe this has outdone the termites proportionately. Not quite. You see, in Africa, we have the world's tallest termite mounds, up to 25 feet tall, up to 40 feet in diameter at the base. Huge edifices compared to the tiny termites that make it. And in proportion to the termite size, if they were to make something like the Burj Khalifa, it would only be this tall, okay? Whereas this is much taller than that when you take into proportional size of the workers who build it, their size compared to how big a structure they've made. They still have the tallest structures compared to their size of anything that's ever been produced in world history. Now, termite mounds are not only just huge in proportion to the size of the termites that build them, they have a very practical purpose. The termites like to cultivate a certain fungus that they feed to their young. They like the wood fiber too, but this fungus especially they like to eat and feed to their young. And that fungus is very temperature sensitive. It has to be kept at an optimal temperature, no more than 1 degree plus or minus the optimum to grow the best. Believe it or not, these blind little termites, can't even see, scurry around, and by their instinct programmed into them by God, they can make these huge edifices taller in proportion to their size any skyscraper we've ever made in world history, and they put in it a venting system with doors that can open and close. Yeah, so they have their own air conditioning system. And it's based on the fact that the termite mound above the ground, of course, absorbs solar heat. As the sun beats on it, it warms up. Warm air rises. So as the air warmed up in these chambers here rises and vents out, it sucks and pulls in air from these underground passageways, which under the earth are cooler. And so they constantly open and close these passages. They have their built-in biological thermometers, so they all agree on what's the correct temperature. And although they're blind, they built this thing, and they know how to operate it, opening and closing in just the right amounts to keep the temperature as good as any of our modern thermostats, within 1 degree, plus or minus the exact optimum temperature. Now, this is a form of air conditioning. It uses the rising of hot air being vented away and the pulling in of cool air under the ground to cool it off and to keep a constant temperature. Well, you go to Wikipedia, and they have this picture here of a natural ventilation for high-rise buildings based on, what, the termite model. It so turns out that this is so much more efficient than any of our air conditioning systems. God invented this at the beginning of time with termites, yet we can't beat it. Here we have a building in Zimbabwe, Africa, and this one in London, England. Now, you look at them, it looks like there's a whole bunch of chimneys on the roof, but they aren't chimneys, they're vents. And as the building heats up in the sunlight and the temperature rises, they allow it to vent out the roof. That pulls in cool air from under the ground to replace it, and you have a natural ventilation, natural air conditioning. Because this is so much more efficient, it's 90% more efficient than any of our best air conditioning systems. Both of these were built back in the mid-1990s, and over the decades since, they have saved multiple millions of dollars in operating costs over a standard air conditioning system. God not only invented air conditioning first, he invented it better and more efficient than anything that we have today. Worth copying. Now here we have the spiral spring. It's not a leaf spring, which was very ancient, goes back thousands of years. Spiral spring was a relatively modern invention by man done in the 1700s, I believe. And this coil spring is something that man gives himself credit for. Oh, we thought of this, we invented this. But no, we have coiled springs at a very microscopic scale within our ears. And if you didn't have that, you would not hear the words that I am speaking tonight. So within the inner ear, we have these amazing bones here. The hammer, the anvil, and the stirrup, as they're commonly known, more technically known as the malleus, the incus, and the stapes. Okay? These three articulated ear bones connected to the eardrum, as the eardrum vibrates, those vibrations go through these bones to the inner ear where we have the cochlea. And inside the cochlea, we have an amazing organ called the organ of Corti. It is unique to mammals. Excuse me. It's not found in reptiles at all. And yet in mammals, it's the main seat of hearing. If you have all this other stuff, but you don't have the organ of Corti, you're stone cold deaf, which is an amazing thing. Reptiles are supposed to have evolved into mammals, right? Yet there's a radical difference here in the structure of the ears. How in God's name did that evolve? Reptiles have a single ear bone instead of these three articulated ear bones called the columella. And it works just fine. According to evolutionists, reptiles have been thriving on the earth for hundreds of millions of years. So you don't need anything better to survive. Look how long they've supposedly survived. But something better like this does help for man, made in the image of God, able to appreciate the subtle nuances of music. You know, only man indulges in music. And he's equipped with an ear that can really allow him to get all the subtle nuances he wants out of that aesthetically pleasing melody that he's able to create because he's made in the image of God and equipped by God to be able to appreciate it to its maximum. Now, if we look on the inner ear, in the cochlea here, this kind of snail-shell kind of spiral figure we have there, we find that within the cochlea there, here we have the organ of Corti. And it's within the cochlea, but that's the organ of Corti right there, that small little thing. That's an amazingly complex organ, as we shall see when we get a close-up of it here. So it has these two sections. It has this bottom section and an arm that arches over it, and this arm is connected in four different places by little hairs, microscopic hairs. Now this looks like there's only three or four hairs per bundle. There's actually anywhere between 18,500 up to 23,000 of these little hairs. And that is very, very important, as we shall see, because these hairs come in pairs. You have a long hair and you have a short hair. And this long hair vibrates. When the vibration comes through the eardrum and to the cochlea, these long hairs vibrate with the vibrations of sound, and it is attached to the shorter hair to a trap door, and the attachment is not with a string or a tendon. It's a coiled spring that works at up to 100,000 vibrations per second. Very high-pitched sounds, 100,000 wiggles per second. Each time it vibrates, it opens this trap door on the top of the short hair. Now, the short hair has flowing through it positively charged ions, basically protons, okay? So every time this wiggles with the vibration of sound, it opens and shuts this trap door. Every time the trap door opens, one single proton enters the inner ear, okay? Protons being positively charged affect the electrical properties of the inner ear and sends an electrical message to the brain that the brain interprets as music or conversation or just plain noise. So here we have the smallest known true coil spring that's far more resilient than any of our springs. We couldn't make, you know, a steel alloy spring that small and have it work. This is made out of protein technology that got invented. And it is amazing in that it can last. You know, some people up to 100 years old have perfect hearing. Their springs work very well, even at that age, okay? So it's an amazing thing that God did. He made them at this microscopic scale. We didn't even know that he had invented it first until modern science with modern microscopy to actually look and see the wonders that God has done. So every time that opens, whether it be music, high-pitched sounds, or whatever, the flow of those protons changing the electrical properties is registered as sound. And if that weren't there, if God hadn't invented the coil spring first, you would indeed not hear anything, not even the words I'm speaking tonight. Well, what do the evolutionists say about all these wonders of creation that man thought he invented first, but a higher intellect thought of first and does it better? Well, Janine Benyus, she is well known as being an advocate of biomimicry, looking at nature, where she says there's genius in nature, but not the genius of God, the genius of evolution, supposedly. So she says we should look at nature and we should realize that nature is the creator of this amazing world. No, there is a creator of nature who is amazing, and it's his design that she is trying to copy. Now then, Francis Crick, who was a Nobel Prize winning scientist, he said biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. That's how they deal with it. It's kind of like the fake news. They don't want you to hear something, you're not going to hear about it. If they don't want you to think a certain way, they're going to do everything in their power to keep you from thinking that way. But the evidence is there, and they have to turn a blind eye and a deaf ear to it to not see it. They willfully reject the truth, the Bible says. Those who are willfully ignore the truth. So when we look at the world of biology, we see the amazing beauty, the inventive genius, the great wisdom and understanding, the great aestheticism that God puts into his amazing creation. And we should stand in awe, we should fall on our knees and say, thank you, God, that you're such a mighty creator. You created this beautiful world that didn't have to be beautiful for us to survive, but you did it because you love us and you want us to have pleasure. He gives us all good things to enjoy, including the simple pleasure of seeing beautiful works of art and flowers and trees and animals and design within them that we didn't think of first, but we sure try to copy without giving credit to the original copyright holder, the one who thought of it first and who should be honored accordingly. Those who reject it, the Bible says, are without excuse, as Romans 1:20 says, ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature and attributes, that is, his eternal power and divinity, have been made intelligible and clearly discernible in and through the things that have been made, his handiworks. Tonight we've looked at just some of his marvelous handiworks that are so good, so wise, that we're trying to copy them to this day. And we do copy them, but we just never seem to very often be able to copy them to work as effectively and efficiently as God's original design. We make crude copies. That's about the best we can do. But we still recognize the genius there, that it should be copied. But they're without excuse when they don't realize his handiworks declare his glory, declare that he exists. You know, I don't know any greater insult to a great artist like Leonardo da Vinci for somebody to come along and say, yeah, then no, master artist created that Mona Lisa? Why, centuries ago, somebody just randomly threw paint on that canvas and the laws of chemistry and physics and chance just worked together and here we have this smiling maiden called Mona Lisa. Never in the history of the world of science have we ever seen something like that happen. There are no laws of chemistry, physics, or chance that can explain that. There's only one thing that explains a masterpiece, and that's a master artist. And when we see the masterful artistry and engineering in the universe, in life, in man, even at the microscopic scale, we should fall on our knees and give glory to God. We should acknowledge him, we should thank him that he made us in his image, and we should thank him that he loved us enough to die so that we could have eternity with him. No more sorrow, no more sickness, no more pain, no more tears, no more curse, no more death. The former things will be passed away forever because our God not only created us, he loves us enough to die for us, and that's as good as it gets. That's the good news. So again, I do have this available out there at the table under the title of Biomimetics, means God invented it first, part three. And I don't know if we have any time. We can entertain a few questions, Pastor, if that would be all right. So if you have a question, raise your hand, and if you're lucky, I might call on you, but you got to be lucky. Okay, anybody feel lucky? Okay, all right.
I want to know how long those termite mounds, how long does it take them to get to be the size that it is? They must work really fast.
Well, that is a good question, and, you know, it's different termites in different areas work at different speeds, so it's kind of dependent on where they're at. The biggest ones are found in Australia and in Africa. Yeah, that's an interesting thing. In my research, I didn't actually research that particular aspect, so that's something that you can look up. Yes?
So how old are those ones that you showed?
I don't know that either. There are some that have been abandoned, and because they're, you know, practically as hard as concrete, they could have been there, you know, for all we know, for many years, decades, perhaps even centuries. They don't wear out that easily. You know, if an elephant can't knock them over, they don't knock over very easy, so... But there are some that have been abandoned, and even the scientists aren't sure exactly how long it's been. So, but they are amazing when you think about it. Okay, any other questions? If not, I'll be back at the DVD table. I'll be glad to field any questions there. And Pastor Jeremy, if you want to come forward and close us out with a word of prayer. Thank you so much for coming out. First time in a long time on a Sunday night. Appreciate it. God bless you.
It's been great just to be together again tonight. Thank you for coming. I really enjoyed just seeing a number of things that God made, but tonight, just I appreciate your perspective in showing God's beauty, his artistic design in so many of these things. We just finished studying the book of Ecclesiastes together, where we're constantly reminded to enjoy life, and these beautiful pictures are reminders of the things that God's given us to enjoy, so thank you for that reminder tonight. Let's be dismissed in a word of prayer. Lord, it's been good to be in your house today. It's been good to fellowship together as your people. It's been good to step back and just marvel at your power in creation, your design, at how every little thing works exactly as it should. And Lord, we can't even begin to copy it as well as you have made it. Lord, we just want to offer our humble praise to you for the kind of God that you are. Lord, we rejoice in the fact that what we see and experience, even in a broken, fallen, sin-cursed world, just displays your glory and your beauty. And we enjoy it tonight. And we have really just marveled at what we've seen today, so thank you for that. Now, Lord, as we go into this week, as we sometimes get burdened down with the heaviness of what we bear in life and just the frustrations of things happening in our world, may our thoughts return to today. May we find ourselves looking up and just remembering that you are the one who's created us and you are the one who is accomplishing all things for your purpose and for your glory, and you've brought us into your purposes and made us a part of that. Lord, we're grateful to be a part of your family, so thank you for that. Now dismiss us with your blessing, we pray as we go. In Jesus' name, amen.